On today's episode, Rob and I interviewed Roy Rappaport. He is a self-described people-oriented people leader who has decades of experience working for several marquee tech companies, including Macromedia, Slack, and Netflix. We talked about lots of fun stuff that I know many of you are going to get value out of, you're going to find useful, and you're going to find entertaining as well. We love Roy because he's blunt, he's direct, he's a fabulous human. You could feel the love in his heart. And we talked about leadership, what leadership means to Roy, why he doesn't necessarily want to be seen as a great leader, but as someone who makes an impact, as someone who, at the end of the day, he feels like his work matters. So we really dove into what leadership is to him. He had some fun stories to tell, keeping everyone anonymous as well, not sacrificing anyone's identity, protecting the innocent. We talked about how he views retirement. We talked about just so many things that are related to not just leadership from a tactical and strategic perspective, but we also went deep as well and talked about shame and how it's okay for leaders to feel shame. And that actually a lot of the best leaders, people-oriented leaders, leaders who make a great impact, may feel shame from time to time, and how to deal with that. He touched on his own spiritual and religious ideas, not just ideas, but like how a lot of what he does is grounded in his religion. And that is really, I'm sure you'll feel, where his love comes from. So please enjoy this inspiring, entertaining conversation that is filled with lightness and fun, but also filled with love as well. Enjoy. Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where I share insights on how to upgrade your career as a technical leader. I'm Jen Funk. I am a career coach and co-CEO of the People Stack, along with my husband, Rob Allen. If you'd like to find out more about what we do here at the People Stack, please check out our free training at training.thepeoplestack.com. You're going to learn the four strategic and mindset shifts that our clients have used to command 300, 400, 500K plus salaries as tech leaders while living lives of abundance, freedom, and joy. And now, without further ado, please enjoy today's episode.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode of the People Stack podcast. Joining Jen and I today is Roy Rappaport, who has been a people-oriented people leader for the last three decades, spanning some of the biggest West Coast companies you can think of, including Macromedia, Slack, and Netflix. How are you doing today, Roy?
Pretty good, Rob. It's good to see you again.
It's good to see you too, man. It's good to have a great conversation about careers and tech and all of that fun stuff. You're one of the many folks that usually when you're spouting an opinion someplace, I'm like, yep, what Roy said. And that's exceedingly rare nowadays, especially as people are posting on the LinkedIn and the, we're going to still call it Twitter, and all of the other fun places about what it means to be a people leader and what it means to continue your journey for dream careers. So it is an absolute pleasure to get to speak with you. So in my very quick intro, I mentioned Macromedia, Slack, and Netflix, which are some of those companies that are like, hell yeah, that would have been a fun place to be. What of those roles would you have considered to be dream roles, if any, or any other roles that I did not mention?
Gosh, I got to tell you, It's interesting because in my professional life, like in my day-to-day, I'm sort of like an ex-ops person, and I sort of tend to be a little perhaps conservative and pessimistic. I can always sort of look to the future and see how things could go wrong. When I look at my past, though, I think I tend to be an exceedingly positive and optimistic person. There's no job that I've had that I wouldn't say was in some way kind of a dream job that I learned something in and had some really interesting experiences in. The shortest stint I had was at a company called Fisher Investments. That was about 9 months. And that was a weird place to work at. Also, it's worth noting I was there for only 9 months, which is by far my shortest stint. I'm not a quick job hopper. And even at Fisher Investments, I would tell you, like, I had some really interesting experiences starting with the interview and all through my time there. So these have all been, you know, dream jobs, I've got to tell you.
Wonderful. And when you think of what makes a role a dream role, what are some of the components that stick out for you as just something that just needs to be there?
So obviously, this is a uniquely personal question, right? Like, everybody's going to have different answers for this.
Indeed.
I'm lucky because I've been having conversations. So I left Netflix earlier this month, and I've been talking to a bunch of companies about potentially working there. So there's a fundamental question, like, what are you looking for? So I've had this conversation with a few different companies, some very different companies too. And for me, it comes down to feeling like my work matters, like I'm actually making a difference. You know, my last week at Netflix, which, as I mentioned, I left Netflix earlier this month, but actually my last day sort of working for Netflix, not getting paid for Netflix, but working, was May 19th. And I found out eventually that, and it was a kind of a complicated story, that it was going to be May 19th on Monday, May 16th. So I had about a week where I knew that this is my last week at Netflix. And I spent a bunch of that time talking with people and doing what I would probably say feels a bit like a victory lap. But I also still use that week to do what I consider to be useful things. I wrote a memo about how I think about disagree and commit as a concept. And I released that memo, I think about 3 or 7 minutes before 5 p.m. on Friday, when, you know, I was going to leave the building, because it felt like it mattered. It felt like my work there was useful and it was having impact for other people. And for me, that's fundamentally not just a dream job, but that's like the deal killer. Like, I need to know that my work actually makes a difference. And ideally, I need to feel that on a daily basis.
Wonderful. And as you're out on either the pro leisure circuit now or heading in for new roles coming up, what is it that would draw you to a particular role besides the fact that you are going to be making a difference within that organization?
I think partly it's knowing that the company is in the aggregate, in some way or another, making the world a little better. And my bar for that is relatively low. As you mentioned before we started recording that I can be spicy here and that we're not being sponsored by anyone. So, you know, there are definitely companies I would not want to work with, for example, pretty much any NFT or crypto company, I don't think have a meaningfully positive impact on humanity. But, you know, frankly, I would even make a case that Meta has a net positive impact on humanity. They're probably at the bottom of my list in terms of that calibration, but they're still above the line. So one thing is the company needs to actually be contributing to humanity, not 100%. Every company does, I think, bad things, and living in a capitalistic society, we all make compromises. But I need to be able to sleep at night and know that I'm not making the world like actively worse for my kids.
Right.
The other thing is, I also know these days that I'm probably far better at leading leaders than I am at leading ICs. So that's probably going to be a meaningful block toward joining a very small company. But I'm okay with that. So those are the top two things. Having interesting tech is nice, but I got to tell you, I'm much more interested in tech and engineering in my personal life these days than I am in my professional life. in my professional life, it really is all about perhaps less people and more organizations. And that's worth distinguishing, because I think that in the beginning of my career, as a people leader, I was mostly focused on people. And in fact, you asked me how to introduce myself, and I said, people-oriented people leader. That was what, like 5-10 minutes ago?
Yep.
I would say that for me, what's more interesting and important is really thinking about organizations and culture and people as sort of like after that. And that means that I can be, to some degree, if I'm being really candid, brutal is the wrong word, potentially heartless about any individual people. When I think about what's best for the organization, for the group, and for the culture that we're trying to maintain.
The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one. In some cases. Yes.
Yeah.
In some cases, yeah. So
that's a famous Captain Kirk quote, I believe, right?
Depending Kirk on or whether... Spock, I forget which one originated it, but yeah.
Depending on which director you're talking about, of course.
Yes, indeed. So that transition from being a leader of people to a leader of organizations and culture within is a fun transition. It's one I greatly enjoyed. What was sort of the tipping point that brought you from focusing on like the individual members of your team predominantly over to the health of the organization structure you were all a part of?
I can't point to a specific point in time. I would say that I would look at experiences and sort of like transitions that helped me figure that out. And there were two of them. One, fundamentally, if you look at my career trajectory, it's not like an up and to the right graph. I've always sort of followed a rough career planning strategy that can be summarized as like, do the next interesting thing that's in front of you. And that means that, for example, I left Robert Half, where I was a manager, to go join Netflix as an IC. Even at Netflix, I was an IC, became a manager, became an IC, became a manager, left to go to Slack, came back as a director. But I would say that it's much easier for me to focus on groups and organizations when I lead leaders than when I lead ICs. The other thing that I was thinking about is, you know, a long time ago, back in, I want to say 2011 or thereabouts, Netflix had a network operations center, a NOC, and they don't have a NOC anymore, at least from the engineering side. And the NOC was kind of a bad place to be for a variety of reasons that are kind of pretty typical for NOCs. There was nothing particularly unusual there. It's not like they were treating people poorly. It's just sort of like some of the fundamental aspects of having a NOC. And I was outside of the NOC and trying to help the NOC get better, having a lot of conversations with the manager of that NOC. And at some point, I actually helped two friends of mine who had not been NOC operators join the NOC, because I thought that adding smart, capable, motivated people to a demotivated, not particularly well-run organization was going to make the organization be more effective. It does not. In fact, what it does is kind of the opposite. It doesn't make the organization worse, but it makes those people worse and less happy. So if you're trying, you know, if you go back to what I said in terms of what I want, which is to have impact, I think impact at scale is about organizations. And a better organization in the aggregate is going to be better for people than a worse organization. And therefore, from the perspective of where to spend my time and effort, that's when I figured out that you got to focus on the organization. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And when you learned that trying to put motivated individuals into a demotivational space, and NOCs tend to be like that, you've got periods of high stress boredom followed by periods of high stress emergency fire drill, and you never know when it's going to pivot from one to the next. When you had that realization, what then? So you took the lesson that you couldn't just throw in higher output individuals or higher
potential performers.
Well, yeah. It's not even that they were higher potential performers. It was just that they were happy and excited to be there. and the people mm-hmm. who were there weren't. So higher motivation mm-hmm. individuals, you can't just throw those in. Did you ever find a way to turn that knock around?
No, it wasn't strictly speaking my job to turn the knock around, which also means I didn't really have a lot of power to turn the knock around. In the end, what ended up happening was that as part of Netflix moving to the cloud and Netflix having more production responsibilities move from IT to engineering, because I was in IT at the time, so I feel pretty comfortable saying we weren't great at our job. And so at some point, engineering fired us and moved all of that stuff internally to engineering. But as part of that move, eventually the knock simply just got dismantled. Most of those people found other jobs at Netflix. Some of them, I think, are still actually at Netflix, like, you know, more than 10 years later. People tend to, there are a bunch of people I've seen at Netflix who have been around for a very long time. But no, I didn't really see that knock never really got turned around.
Got it. For the individuals that have since moved on, have they recovered their motivation and joy?
I don't know all of them, and I haven't kept all of them, so I don't really know for a fact whether or not they did. But I will say quite a few, I suspect, have. The one or two I can think of, I know have. But I also think that if we want to talk about people leadership for a second, it's also worth noting that one of the reminders here is that when we talk about performance, and even I think it might have been Jen who sort of mentioned something about potential. When we talk about performance or potential, that really has to be assessed within a given context. And somebody can perform not very well at all within a given context, and then you change the context and they're amazing. But if you only know them within that specific context and they weren't performing well, you're going to be like, oh, well, that's not a very good person. My first hire at Netflix was this guy, let's call him Bob. And Bob ended up being kind of mediocre. I ended up firing him. He was both my first hire and my first fire at Netflix. I fired him a year after he joined Netflix because he was mediocre. He wasn't performing very well. And I can sit here and tell you, yeah, Bob's just not very good. Except that, like, Rob, the reason I hired Bob, aside from the fact that he did pretty well at the interviews, is because I had hired Bob at his previous company. Bob had worked for me at Robert Half International. And can I tell you, he was amazing there.
Yeah. So
he was amazing at Robert Half. He came to Netflix, which was a very different company. And while I'll tell you that, like, you know, working for Netflix has been a joy for me, it is not a place that is full of joy for everybody. It has been an acquired taste. So he was great at Robert Half. He left Netflix. And I'm not going to mention the next three companies he went to because I don't want to sort of de-anonymize him. But I then talked with people who worked with him at his next three companies where they're like, oh yeah, you worked with Bob. He's amazing. So amazing, mediocre, amazing, amazing, amazing. What's the conclusion about Bob? Mm-hmm. It wasn't a Bob problem. It was an org problem.
Yeah.
Context is one of my favorite words for exactly that reason.
Yeah. And so what do you see your role, like, as a leader in helping your team members, whether it's other leaders or whether it's ICs or whoever it might be, and helping them find that perfect spot for them?
Well, there's roughly, I would say, three kinds of things that I could be doing, not all at the same time. One is helping that person adapt to the organization. The other is helping the organization be more inclusive and adaptive to the people in that organization. Here's a really minor version of this that's not really meaningful. It's just a easily digestible. You'll see why this is a fun pun here in a second. When I led my first engineering group at Netflix, every time we had a new employee join, we would go out to lunch to celebrate that. And we got into the habit of going out to lunch at Fogo de Chao, which is a Brazilian steakhouse where you get all you can eat meat. And that was amazing. People loved it. And then we had a vegetarian join the team. And the vegetarian was like, I don't really love Fogo de Chao. And by the way, one of my engineers was like, but they have a salad bar.
Because that's all you need.
And I know you're not sponsored by Fogo de Chao, but I will tell you, their meat options are way better than their, you know, salad option. I'll leave it at that. So we changed our launch decisions to basically not go to like a meat heavy or meat centric restaurant. Now, that's of course pretty minor in terms of inclusion and belonging, but you know, it's also a relatively easy way to explain sort of like how you change the culture of the team to make it fit a broader group of people. But Jen, the third thing I can do is come to the conclusion that the org as it needs to be and the person as they are and are likely to be and should be are not a good fit for each other. Part of my job is to help people be successful. And sometimes what I come to is the decision that they're not going to be successful here. And it's my job to help them get a chance to be successful somewhere else and let them go.
Yeah, that's really refreshing. And that's, as you can probably guess, a huge part of what we do. And it's easier, I would imagine, for us because we're not a member of that organization, right? So it's easy for us to say, is this really a fit to work here when we're not their boss? And so it goes to show your level of ability to really kind of detach from, okay, I work from this organization versus I want to be your mentor and your guide to be that unbiased mentor, even though your loyalties do lie with the organization.
I'm not sure. So I have perhaps two problems with sort of accepting what you just said. One, I have to tell you, I have an emotional distaste to the idea of calling me a mentor.
Interesting.
I have been willing to sort of like refer to some of my relationships as a mentor-mentee relationship when the other person really wanted it. Or Netflix has occasionally run formal mentorship programs. So like if I'm volunteering as a mentor, fine, I'm a mentor. But I don't love that term, I have to tell you. Okay. It feels presumptuous and it feels like it feels like taking power. I much prefer to characterize the conversations and relationships I have with people as simply being an external party that they can talk with and hopefully have some good ideas that they can benefit from. And have it be much more two-way than, you know, Roy, you know, on the mountain handing down some wisdom.
Okay. Yeah. So it's really just a semantics thing then. So I definitely don't see mentor as you must bow to my power and I know all, right? Like we don't even do that with our clients. Right. So yeah. Yeah.
I'm certainly not here to tell you what to, you know, how to call your all. But for me, I tend to shy away from that because it feels like it comes with power baggage that I just sort of shy away from. The other thing is, I have an ethical responsibility to my company, but that is one of many responsibilities I have. By the way, I was told that since this is not sponsored or monetized, I can drop expletives in this conversation.
Okay, sure.
I'm just going to get that out of the way right now. Expletive. So to get a little potentially, I don't know, controversial, maybe not controversial, but to get a little spicy, let's talk a little about religion. I'm Jewish. I was born and raised in Israel. I'm a terrible Jew, by the way, but I have some strong opinions about how I want to be as a Jew. And I'm informed by a bunch of things in Jewish religion, one of which is the concept of tikkun olam, which basically means fixing the world. The idea is that, you know, Jews should go around and just like, it's almost like picking up like little, you know, bits of trash on the floor. When you find a way to make the world a little better, you should do that. I'm a firm believer in tikkun olam. I'm a firm believer that my job is to make the world a little better. And that is a higher calling than whatever professional or ethical responsibility I have for whatever company I work at. It should basically never come in conflict with the ethical responsibilities I might have for a company. I'm never going to like break ethical rules, but where I could come in conflict with some things that the company might like me to do is in terms of, for example, how I share information with people to help them decide whether or not they want to be in the company. And in fact, whether or not I actually at some point go, hey, you know, like we've had some conversations about what's good for you and your career. when I look over the next 2 to 3 years, I'm not sure that this is the place where you're most likely going to get what you want as effectively as you could elsewhere. So you might want to think about going somewhere else. There have been times when I've done that, and my company has not necessarily been a big fan of that approach, and that's okay. Part of the nice thing about this being public is that any potential employer of mine who ends up seeing this gets to make a more informed decision about whether or not they want me in their company.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious, just to kind of close a loop on this one little piece of the conversation. When you said that, maybe this isn't the place for you, how do people typically respond?
Most of the time people responded with like, yeah, I kind of had that sense, but I needed somebody to actually say it. I got to tell you, Jen, I feel like people are really smart. And in my experience, I feel like 80%, and by the way, I made that number up, but it's high. I feel like 80% of the time when I tell somebody that they should do something and why or how to think about something, there's some version of like, they already knew that. They just didn't, they didn't trust themselves, or they don't think of themselves the way they think about other people. One of the easiest and laziest, because I'm a super lazy person, I got to tell you, ways I can help people make decisions sometimes is I simply tell them like, what would you tell somebody who is kind of like you, but who reports to you if they were dealing with this kind of situation? And people who are like completely struggling and completely have no idea how to deal with something are like, oh, well, you know, if like somebody under me was dealing with this, I'd be like, I'm going to do A, B, C, and D. And I'm like, cool.
So
it's not often been, it's rarely been like an eye-opening, oh my gosh, you know, I suddenly discovered something. It's usually just a confirmation of, I think, what people already know.
That's great. Often people just need permission. The way that we say it, often people just need permission to go after their dream. And if it's from their boss, you know, all the better. It can be that permission slip.
And to be clear, it's not always been, and in fact, it's quite often not been their boss. I remember at Slack, I was working with a senior engineering manager who had gone essentially to war with his VP because his VP was awful and he won the war. So the VP was taken out of the equation. And because of the way he had conducted himself in this political war, he got into a massive hole from a social capital perspective. And we sat down, and this person was reporting to the same boss that I was. So we were peers. And so this person sat me down, and at some point he was like, look, Roy, you know, I really trust and respect your judgment. So he wasn't very smart, but we'll put that aside. But here's what happened. And I feel like it's going to take me probably like a year to sort of like just get back to neutral. So like, what do you think I should do? And I was like, frankly, I remember my exact words, and I still will sanitize a little bit. I said, frankly, you should effing leave. Because if you look at the opportunity cost of just digging yourself back to zero over the next year, like what else could you be doing with this year that you just spent, you know, just getting back to zero? And he said, thank you. And then I think about 6 weeks later, he ended up that he announcing that he was leaving the company. And I sat down with my boss and I was like, yeah, 6 weeks ago, I told him that he should probably leave.
Yeah, that's doing a great service to them. I remember one time I was going to say, you know, you're a really great leader, Roy. And I remember the first time that we met, I don't know if you remember this. We were just starting with the people stack and we were figuring out how to market it. And there was some language that we were using around how to be a great leader, how to be an even better leader. And you said to me, this was at the Calibrate conference. There was like a whole bunch of people. And you said to me, you know what? For me, that's not what I want. Like that wouldn't resonate with me, like to be a great leader. It's the same kind of thing that you're talking about today. Like I want to have impact. I want to know that my work matters. But what I want to say, take what's useful from this and leave the rest without judgments. What you just described to me, and I mean this like from my heart, means being a great leader.
Thank you, Jenna. I appreciate that. It's worth noting that in these sort of conversations and in general on the internet, we only talk about the positive things. You know, I just told you a bunch of stories that basically make me look good. I've had my share of failures. I've had my shares of failures that, frankly, I'm somewhat ashamed of. But because they're visible, generally speaking, to relatively few people, it's easy to develop an image of me as a great leader. I would say I try pretty well. Some of the things I don't love, as I mentioned to you, I don't love being thought of as a great leader. There are some things I have done. I'm willing to describe some of my actions as a leader as pretty great, and some of my actions as a leader as very much not great. But I tend to focus on actions rather than like a being. It's kind of like, you know, allyship. If somebody defines themselves as an ally word, and I've seen people say, look, ally is not an adjective. It is it's an action, like acting as an ally right name. I find that framing attractive both for allyship, but also for leadership.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And that's actually one of the things that we teach and espouse and believe very, very, very much is that when you're taking action, there really is no ultimate right or wrong if you are in alignment with your own personal mission where you're trying to go. You take an action, you measure what happened, and then you take a next decision and a next action based on what data you've collected. Now, there are things that you can look back on in retrospect and say, this took me off of the line that I was hoping to get to. But all of those lessons, all of those things that you've learned are prelude to whatever you're going to be up against next.
I think that's a great and empowering statement, and you should definitely stick to it. I think that's a really wonderful way to tell other people how to do leadership.
I hear you. About. Yes.
In 2021, I was at Netflix, and I was I was part of many Slack channels, as all of us are. One of them was for basically every leader in the organization was a part of, so about 30 people or so, everywhere from like first level line managers all the way up to the VP. At the time, I was actually, no, our VP had already left, so not there. So basically, like the top four people in the organization were the senior directors, one of which was me. And one of the managers made a statement, an unfortunate statement, that from an DEI perspective, wasn't great. He wasn't in my line of command. If he was in my line of command, I would have dealt with it differently and much more thoughtfully, because I was much more willing. I would have been much more aware of the power differential. But roughly speaking, because of the way I'd been raised at Netflix, I figured basically, if you're not under me, I have no power over you. So I can say anything and I can just relate to you as a fellow coworker. And so we had a bit of a conversation, and it was a public conversation about what he did and why it landed poorly. And a few things happened as a result of that. For one thing, that guy had an awful weekend. And I know about that because he wrote me a long letter at the end of that weekend about basically all the conversations he had with his wife about it, how he felt about it. And the other thing that happened was at least one other leader in my organization, who, by the way, had been at the organization for about a week, told me later that he, like that day, he read that interaction and went home and was talking to his husband. And he was like, I'm not sure if I came to the right place. That was a grave error. I had made at least a few days of somebody's life hell. Like, I had made his emotional experience of working in the company profoundly alienating and scary. And I had inadvertently taught a few people, at least one of whom was willing to tell me, that they better not make any sort of misstep in public. Neither of these things are things that I would like to do. So we can talk about this. Objectively and thoughtfully and say, well, you know, we made a mistake. You learn from that, you move on. And I did learn from that, and I did move on. But the thing is, and this is something I tell people leaders a lot, you know, when you're an engineer, your work is writing code. And virtually every engineer writes bugs. And most of the time, because most of us are not working in like defibrillator software, our bugs will not cause anybody to die. So if you're an engineer, especially if you've been around for a while, you learn that basically, oh, I made a bug, I fixed it, no big deal, and you don't have an emotional response to it. The problem with being a people leader is that when we ride bugs, people suffer. And that is just one story about times that I rode a bug and people suffered. And yes, objectively, as long as I am committed to being a people leader, and I am, because gosh, I can show you my code. I'm an awful engineer. As long as I'm committed to people being a people leader, I have to accept that. But that doesn't mean I can sort of simply objectively accept that and be like, yep, yeah, well, you know, that's just what happens. Every time that happens, I feel shame and I feel bad because my bugs hurt people.
I have to believe, though, that your next action upon realizing that was a corrective action that at least righted the ship somewhat for those two individuals and the others that were paying attention.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I talked to both that person who I had the conversation with. I talked to the person who told me about the conversation with his husband. And then I actually, like, the next leadership meeting we had, I actually addressed the whole organization. But, man, if I run over your foot and break a bunch of bones in it, and then I go, I'm really sorry, Rob, and I'll pay for your hospital bill, and, you know, I'm happy to, like, bring you food, I can do everything in my power to make up for that, and I should. But the pain that I caused you is still the pain that I caused you, and there's no taking it back. So I can do the best, most responsible and ethical thing I can do as a people leader and as a human being, but inevitably, there are things that we sometimes do that just will leave pain that can't really be taken back. And the only thing I can do is learn from that, try to amortize that over other organizations, other people, and try to make it mean something, you know?
Yeah.
But that doesn't make it good.
Yeah. I have a question that's bubbling, so allow me to sort of think out loud for a bit. This idea, so we go deep, and I think you know Rob better than you know me, but like we really go deep when it comes to like emotions and talking about how we're feeling and talking about how that's affecting external outcomes. And so I'd love to sort of beam down to your world in terms of this feeling of shame. And so that's where this question is. It's from a place of curiosity and like, what is the Roy model of shame and leadership and mistakes? And there's this whole fun sort of area to explore. So the question that I'm going to ask may seem kind of superficial, but it's not. It's like, hey, tell us where you're at or what your model of the world is here. So if a leader feels shame, does that make them a bad leader?
No, but, and this is a conversation I've had with some other leaders. If a leader doesn't feel shame, that doesn't make them a bad leader either.
Mm-hmm.
Add people who attached a personal meaning and value to shame. In fact, I remember one of my favorite, there's this guy, Blake Pinedo. One of these days, you should talk to Blake. He works at Netflix. He's a director. Amazing human being. I remember having a long disagreement with Blake. Because Blake's stance was, if you made a mistake or you screwed something up, I want to see you feeling bad about it.
Ah, okay. And you disagree with that.
I mean, look, Blake is Blake. He can do whatever the heck he wants. But I certainly don't subscribe. I would subscribe to all of his other newsletters, but I would not subscribe to them.
Very good. Very good. And I would say just for personal reasons that I'm with you on this, right? That it's sometimes we feel shame and sometimes we don't. It's our behaviors. It's I do everything we can to fix it. And that the, you know, I subscribe to the Brené Brown newsletter on shame, which is the way that she talks about it is the best petri dish for shame to keep growing is basically isolation and to not talk about it. So to even just say, hey, I did this thing and I feel ashamed and I want to fix it. That's just showing to me and anyone who does that is showing themselves to be a wonderful person internally. And wonderful people and great leaders make mistakes all the time and they fail all the time. And so that's what I love about this conversation is it's this fun sort of what's going on internally versus what's going on externally.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to, hopefully I'm not going to get in informal trouble, not legal problem, trouble, but informal trouble with some of my ex coworkers from Netflix when I tell this story. Back in, I want to say 2011, Netflix decided it was going to split the company. A lot of people know about this. It became kind of a hilarious screw up. They created this other entity called Quixtar. At some point it leaked and it turned out to be a bad idea. So they reversed it. Netflix stock went from like $300 a share to like $50 a share. The good news is this is pre their one to seven split. So, you know, it continued to go up after that. But like for like a year, it was a little bit tough. Like that was meaningfully hard. And after this whole thing ended, there was a postmortem conversation. It wasn't like a standard sort of like incident postmortem. It was just Reed, our CEO and founder at the time. I mean, Reed is still the founder, but he's retired as CEO. Reed stood up in front of the whole organization and talked about how the decisions were made and why. And one of the things he talked about was the mistakes that he made. The other one that I was really hoping for, and I expected to have to ask for it, but I didn't. He volunteered, was like how his staff failed in basically not stopping him from doing the dumb thing. But Jen, I remember the way he ended that conversation an hour into it. And he said, I have caused, I don't know, damage or whatever to this company. And I feel shame and humiliation for it. And that was the last day I ever doubted Reed's leadership and his ability to lead the company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he was being so vulnerable. Was it the vulnerability that did it for you?
Vulnerability is one of those interesting words. It's become very popular. Like everybody uses that word and it can mean so many different things. Yeah, you can say vulnerability. You can say honesty. You can say candor. You can say acknowledging like his emotions and feelings in a company that has not traditionally sort of, you know, been a big like emotions and feelings sort of company. For me, it was admitting the personal magnitude of the mistake.
Okay.
You know, we're going through not unprecedented. We go through these every few years, right? But for the last 18 months or so, we've seen a bunch of layoffs. And those layoffs come with messages from the CEOs. I'm sure you both have read them. And they, at some point, I would say there's like a 90% similarity between virtually all of them. Every once in a while, you have an outlier. But like, other than that, there's like 90% similarity between all of them. And a big part of that is like, this is happening because I screwed up and I take responsibility.
Okay. Moving on. And that's not necessarily vulnerable. I see what you're saying now. I'm just saying it because I need to say it versus I'm really bearing my soul here. I am really talking about what I'm personally feeling. And sometimes it can be hard to tell the difference, whether that's vulnerability or I just need to say this.
Yeah. You know, when your layoff notice sounds exactly like the layoff notice that you would have gotten if you asked ChatGPT to generate a layoff notice, it's a little hard to know how much of that is you.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's not authentic vulnerability. Authentic vulnerability is being honest and unguarded. Authentic vulnerability is being more deep and connecting more deeply with the audience and leaving yourself open to be kicked in the teeth by whatever comes next.
Yeah, and if I'm going to be a little spicy here, I will say that a lot of the trend in tech companies and especially larger tech companies over the last, like, let's say 10 years, I think has made it harder and harder for senior leaders to be vulnerable, authentic, and honest with their organization.
Yes.
Interesting.
We, as employees of companies, made this problem worse. And then we complain that people aren't authentic with us because they're not being completely honest. When we don't recognize the fact that at some point it became super sort of popular and comfortable that if your CEO says something dumb or something you don't like, you savage them. You respond to that in a way that you would never react to, say, like a coworker you actually cared about saying something dumb. Because one of the things that I've, at some point I figured out, and I was figuring it out for sort of from the bottom, is once somebody is more than about two power levels above you, it's really hard to see them as a human being. They're just the role. And if they're just the role, then however you're feeling rage about what they said, however insulted you are, you know, you can just say that to them because you're just responding. You're just having a conversation with a role, not with a human being who's probably having a bad day, because chances are you're not the only person who's telling them that they said something kind of dumb.
Had a wonderful human being that worked for me who was very, 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 very good at pointing out the thing that everybody knew was wrong in a way that was almost guaranteed to get action. And they had a tendency to overreach sometimes with that, but with some coaching, they got even better at it. And now I believe they're enjoying a wonderful career where that's their job. But yeah, I totally hear you, because when things happen in public or in Signal or, you know, some of the other social networks, yeah, it's too easy to pile on and armchair quarterback how that role should have been handled without our favorite word, context, and then make it that much harder. Do you believe that it gets harder still when it's a public organization that relies on public perception, that in order to maintain share price, shareholder value, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and is making decisions from that perspective rather than making the world a better place?
Well, I mean, I would say most organizations don't have as a primary goal making the world a better place. Certainly, I would argue that the vast, I would seek to better understand a publicly held company owned by shareholders that says our work, our goal is to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say that the bigger the exposure is, the less opportunity for compassion and humanity there is. You know, in case people aren't aware of this, the way we know each other is through this engineering leadership Slack called RAN's Leadership. RAN's Leadership has something like, I want to say, what, 28,000 people now or so?
Yeah, I think we're brushing 29,000, actually.
Yeah. And when I joined RAN's Leadership, I want to say in 2015, I think that was my first post somewhere in June of 2015, I think there were like 200, 300 people there. And when it was a 200-300 person organization, when somebody said something dumb, and gosh knows people said something dumb all the time, people would be like, hey, what do you mean by that? Like, and there was a presumption of like, hey, let's figure out what happened there. There was a curiosity. It wasn't random strangers interacting on the internet. It was members of a group trying to work together. I don't know what your experience of RAN's Leadership these days is, but I would say it's far more random people on the internet. It's not as bad as, I was going to say Twitter, but Twitter doesn't exist anymore. It's not as bad as, I don't know, X. I can't say that without laughing. It's not as bad as perhaps X, but fundamentally it's a bunch of strangers who kind of are unlikely to sort of, you know, extend the same humanity and compassion to each other as they would friends. And the larger a company gets, the more public a company gets, the more you get to experience that. I was at Netflix from 2009 to 2023. In 2009, I think we had something like 400 or 500 people. In 23, we had something like 11,000 people. It was a far less intimate place, and it was a place that where I saw far less grace and kindness than before. No, actually, let me rephrase that. It was a play, Netflix 23. I saw far more grace and kindness coming down than Netflix 09. But in Netflix 23, I saw far less grace and kindness going up than in Netflix 09.
It's interesting.
And I suspect that's virtually inevitable.
Yeah, I can think of a couple of other examples where I've seen a similar pattern. So I was in a similar cohort joining RANs. I was in a similar cohort joining Stack Overflow, including the admin back channel for Stack Overflow. And I can chart the same progression of we're talking to well-meaning humans here. And no, you're just some internet number now. And I have studiously avoided channels in the RANs leadership Slack that have that level of discourse, and focused instead on more of the hobbyist channels recently. Recently meaning since 2016. But yeah, and that's honestly, that's what we tell our folks when we tell them to go join the leadership Slack. We tell them to stick to local and hobbyist channels and channels for things that are really, really powerfully in your interest, like DevOps or security or crypto, if that's what your flavor is, what have you. Avoid US politics. Avoid other types of channels where things are going to get spicy intentionally.
Yeah. But I will say, and this is, I'm going to say this with regards to RANs leadership, but I think it's also applicable to the workplace. One of the nice things about RANs leadership is, you know, 29,000 people, you get to know people that you want to listen to. And one of the most powerful thing I've seen happen is people create private channels where they invite some people. And in those private channels, you go back to that deep, vulnerable intimacy where you can say anything and be well regarded. And the reason this is relevant, not just about RANs leadership, is because I think that's something that we all also need at work. You know, I remember talking to an engineering manager at Slack who was having some problems, and she set up a one-on-one with me. She wasn't in my org in any way. I didn't even know her at the time. She set up a one-on-one and she said, people told me I need to talk to you and I'm not exactly sure why. And I was like, okay, cool. Welcome to Slack. How are you doing? And it turned out that she wasn't having a great time, to be honest. And we talked about why and what was happening. And at the end, I was like, you're not alone. The way you're thinking about things is not necessarily publicly talked about or publicly held here, but there are a bunch of other people around here who share your perspective. You need to find your tribe. And I'm here to tell you that I'm part of it. And she started crying, but it was apparently a good cry.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's really awesome.
Finding, especially as companies get bigger, but even frankly at Slack, when it was, you know, a tenth of the size of Netflix, I still found it useful to have my tribe, the people with whom I can actually have honest conversations and have really difficult and awkward conversations and know that I'm not going to be judged for it or, you know, publicly excoriated for it.
Yeah. One of the questions that we get that our clients ask a lot, and I'm going to ask you for your perspective on this, Roy. One of them is they may not ask it exactly this way, but it's the, how do I find the humanity in the company that I'm working for, especially if it's big? It's a find your tribe. I love that. And like, and I'm a member of that. That's so reassuring. The other question is, how can I relate to my boss or my boss's boss as a human? How can I do that better? How can I see this person as a human when all of the things that you said, which are true, you know, it's they just seem like it's just for the profit or it's just for the money. I feel so disconnected from them. What context, what guidance would you give to someone who came to you and said, I really do want to relate to my boss's boss more. I want to see them as human. Show me the way to that.
If you're lucky, that person will actually help you do that. Netflix is the head of engineering is this woman named Debbie Black. And when Debbie joined the company, my VP had already left, so I was temporarily reporting to her. Debbie's first day at Netflix, I want to say, was August 1st, 2021. My first one-on-one with Debbie was August 2nd, 2021. And we sat down and we had a conversation. And she told me about her kids and she told me about her garden. And it was impossible to relate to her as anything other than as a human being in that conversation. Now, that's something that Debbie was really great at, and not everybody is really great at. It's unlikely that if somebody reporting to me comes into the company reporting to me, my first one with them is going to be about like me. It's probably actually very much going to be not about me. It's going to be about them. But one, you can express interest and curiosity while trying to, of course, figure out what the right balance is in terms of being nosy and asking inappropriate questions and, you know, what's just getting to know you. I solved that problem, by the way, by having very poor sense of boundaries and just asking, you know, inappropriate questions. And, you know, that has, roughly speaking, worked most of the time. But the other one is, you know, look, in the end, your boss and your boss's boss don't actually have to help you do that. You can just try to remember that every time you interact with them. Because, like, you know, here's a secret. Every human being we deal with is a human being. Except for the aliens, but that's a different podcast.
Yeah, they're scheduled for a couple of months from now.
It's up to us to remember that and to figure out who we want to be in our conversations and our relationship with them. You know, I go back to Blake, and at some point Blake asked me, how do you manage to give people sometimes like really hard feedback in some cases being like, hey, your job is at risk, you could get it fired, and have that conversation, roughly speaking, be usually pretty positive and affirming and supportive. I do a lot of code switching at work and outside of work. And one of the ways in which I code switch is with some people, I tend to use more religious language, and with some people, I use far less religious language. Obviously, we're talking about religion at work is deeply problematic, which gosh knows has never stopped me. But I thought about it for a second. I told Blake, you know, honestly, when I'm trying to give somebody feedback, one of the questions I'm asking myself is, am I coming into this as a manifestation of God's love for them? And if I can't come into this conversation as a manifestation of God's love for them, I need to take a bit of a break. Maybe I'll give them feedback tomorrow or next week. I can't hold out forever, but I shouldn't need to hold out forever. Now, manifestation of God's love, what the heck does that mean? If you're not a particularly religious person, or even if you are, it may not land for you. I'm hoping it's at least something that can be understood as a general principle that people can apply. Am I coming in with good intentions? Am I coming in with your best interests at heart, or at least the best interests of the company at heart? Am I coming in to be helpful, or am I trying to hurt you? That's something that's easier for people, I think, to pay attention to when they talk to people below them than when they talk to people above them. Yeah. But there's no reason to be less thoughtful and caring about answering that question for yourself with the people above you.
100%. Oh my goodness. Yes, it absolutely resonates. It absolutely is in alignment with what we talk about on this podcast with our clients. We use slightly different language, spiritual language. It's like, are you connected with the energy that creates worlds? Are you connected with infinite intelligence? Or even just, are you connected with your inner superhero, your divine within, with your wise self, right? Because your wise self wants to be neutral and at cause, right? I'm a human, you're a human. I'm not going to one up you. I'm not going to one down you. And also I'm at cause here. I'm responsible for how I'm feeling. So if I'm feeling angry, shameful, guilty, worried, probably not the best time to have a mentoring relationship or guiding relationship with someone else.
I'm not here to speak language.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, 100%. Am I a manifestation of infinite intelligence, of God's love, of the love of the universe? Oh, and if I'm not, then I'm going to do whatever I need to do to get reconnected to that. And that, more than anything, I can tell you, has been the core message that has resonated the most with our clients and with our prospective clients. I can tell you that people get that. They get it 100%. So I love that you shared it.
One of the things that you're famous for, Roy, is that before you're going to advise someone in the Slack or other spaces like that, you have a question that you'd go to where you're asking how much, in a sense, how much candor do they really want? Where did that come from?
You don't work with Israelis much?
Sometimes, but not often.
Oh, good for you. I was born and raised in Israel. I still identify as Israeli. I speak Hebrew with my parents. I hold an Israeli passport. Aaron Mayer wrote a book called Culture Map. It's a fantastic book about different world cultures and how they approach work. And I highly recommend it. Mayer describes Israeli culture as very non-hierarchical and extremely blunt. And that's true. And I'm going to take that expletive license, by the way, that I jokingly reused earlier and use it more thoughtfully this time and say that in my experience, Israelis can be kind of assholes. Now, we don't mean to be. We're just, and when we're with each other, it doesn't feel like it. But we tend, my experience of Israelis is we can be kind of like extremely blunt. And I mostly don't work with Israelis. And one of the things I've had to learn at some point is that my whatever natural communication style I had a while ago was at best inconsistently effective, depending on the person I was talking with. And so I had to essentially adjust that. And the biggest part of adjusting that is essentially how candid and blunt will land well. I find, generally speaking, that when I give people the option of choosing what level of candor they want. So one way in which that fails is very few people will go, you know what, I'm actually feeling kind of tender right now. Let me go with like a one. People will usually go a little high, and that's okay. But at least then when I'm candid with them, they know that they chose this, which tends to some degree, perhaps get me in trouble a little less, but also more importantly, I think it causes them a little less pain because it feels more elective and like something they actually signed up for. Now, I will tell you, one of the ways in which I actually failed in doing that, which, by the way, I think maybe literally the first time I remember actually asking this question, was at Netflix. We were talking about moving some scope from one person to another. And it was a conversation with our HR partner in the room, my boss, all of my peers, all of the other managers in the org. And the conversation was going on for about 45 minutes, and I didn't say anything. And at some point, my boss made the mistake of turning to me and saying, you know, Roy, you haven't said anything in the last 45 minutes, which is a surprise. What do you think about this idea? And I thought about it for a second, and I turned to the guy who was about to lose a bunch of his scope, and I was like, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, how blunt would you like me to be? And he was like, 8. And I was like, well, you know, I think Bob is failing. And if we were to do sort of like what Netflix typically does, we would fire Bob and replace him. But what we're trying to do right now is to sort of like adjust the organizational design to help Bob be more successful by moving this scope from Bob to Alice. And like, that's y'all's call. That's just sort of what I think. Did not land well. It landed extremely poorly. But what the interesting thing is, I talked with Bob afterwards and I was like, hey, Bob. Oh, actually, before I talk about that, my next one-on-one with my boss, I came in and literally the first thing he said was, I am pissed off and angry at you for that interaction. I was like, okay, cool. Let's have this conversation. I later found out that one of my other peers in that conversation, when I said that, he described himself as wanting to punch me in the nose in that moment. And my HR partner, for whom this was my first interaction, by the way, we have a really great relationship these days, kind of way thinking I was kind of an asshole. The amusing thing is I talked to Bob afterwards. My next one-on-one with Bob was like, hey, how did that land for you? And he thought about it for a second. He was like, I asked for an 8 out of 10. And I feel like that was an 8 out of 10. So, you know, reasonable. What I neglected to consider, and I try to be a little more thoughtful about it on the Slack, is what level of candor you want is a good thing for me to know. But when there's an audience, I need to also consider the audience. I've not always rated that.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And I think that people vary so widely on their ability to be able to manage their emotions, right? Yeah, give me an 8. when it's like, do you have the self-reflection and self-knowledge and emotion regulation available to respond appropriately to an eight? And by appropriately, what I mean is, can you still be a manifestation of God's love? Can you still be in your inner superhero, even though I've just told you this amazingly, potentially hurtful, but also potentially useful truth? And yeah, most people are not able to do that.
And one of the things that I have to learn when I work with people is essentially like, hey, what's your tolerance for feedback? I don't ask that question very often these days, by the way. I've learned that basically it takes longer, it takes more effort, but it's better for me to sort of like learn how people like feedback, and sort of in my head automatically figure out what level of candor or bluntness works with them.
I can absolutely see the value of that, especially when there is an audience, either in a meeting type of situation or in a Slack or other social network, because there's a bit of self-protection in asking for a higher number. Our version of this is asking if someone is open to coaching on a particular topic, because it has the exact effect that you're talking about. They are now an active participant in what is going to be a conversation around what they said, what they did, what they're thinking, what have you. And that's great. It's also bimodal. So you're either open for coaching or you're not. And most things in Jen and I's sphere is either hell yes or no. So it plays well into that. As you're going through and you're learning people's differing levels for hearing candor and hearing feedback, as you're calling it, what are you noticing for large swaths of individuals who maybe aren't Israeli, for example? They're like a general trend?
My general trend is that if you can leave somebody with the experience of caring deeply about them, deeply and personally about them, you can tell them pretty much anything.
Absolutely true.
And if they don't feel like you personally and deeply care about them, your budget for telling them anything is extremely, extremely constrained.
So we often get to talk to people about their careers and their trajectory, just as we have here. What of these lessons have you applied to your personal life and your parenting? I know you have a handful of children and other aspects of your life.
I don't know that I think of these as very different. I think there's just, you know, there's not a work Roy and a home Roy, and I don't think there's a leadership Roy and a parent Roy. So I'll give you an example. I was thinking about this. I had a fun day on Wednesday, and the fun is in quotes here. My son, who has asthma and anxiety, was on a field trip to a zoo that's like 45 minutes south of us. And he ended up having a medical issue. Basically, he had an asthma attack. That's when they discovered that the rescue inhaler we had given them was out. Stuff happens. And everybody did the right thing. But like his trip, field trip supervisor, whatever the heck they call. Oh, by the way, my son is 8. His field trip supervisor, who, gosh, if he's in his 20s, he's in his early 20s, called me. And he called the park ranger and they called the firefighters. So like my son, who is prone to anxiety and has problems breathing when he has anxiety, suddenly, while he was having an asthma attack, had a whole lot of adults sort of like, you know, around him trying to be helpful and, you know, keeping him alive, which is, by the way, is the best thing about my son, as far as I'm concerned, is he's alive. I like that. I like to maintain that. But obviously it was not helping his anxiety. So anyway, his field trip supervisor called me and was like, we're having this problem. Is there any chance you could drive down with another rescue inhaler? I was like, absolutely, no problem. And he apologized repeatedly for the inconvenience, the fact that he called me, the fact I was driving down. While I was driving down, he was like, hey, if you have to pay anything to park or to get into the park, let me know. I'll cover it. And I was like, So like I came to them, and my first conversation with was with my son, because priorities. And it was super easy. I gave him the inhaler. He puffed two ice. He hugged me and he was like, okay, I'm going to go back to the group. And then I took his group supervisor aside and I was like, hey man, how are you doing? And how do these things typically go? Because it feels like you've been incredibly apologetic while doing exactly what I would hope to do. And while dealing with something that was not your fault, it's not like you gave my son anxiety or asthma, but I'm wondering, like, do you find that a lot of parents, when you have these sort of situations, get kind of grumpy at you? And he was like, yeah, kind of. And I was like, okay, well, you know, hey, I just want you to know, like, exactly what I would have hoped that you would do is what you did. Like, there's no problem here. And Monday, I'm going to go to, this is a Boys and Girls Club thing. So I'm going to go to the director of the Boys and Girls Club. She was out today, this week, and have a conversation with her about how grateful we were and how happy with what happened. And as I was dealing with that on Wednesday, I was like, this is basically incident management and postmortems. There's no difference. There's like, oh, something bad happened and you feel bad. And if there was something that I wanted you to learn, then honestly, today's not the day I'm going to make you learn that anyway. Today is the day that I go like, hey, how are you doing? Everything's fine. That wasn't like people leader Roy showing up. That was just, you know, Roy, who shows up basically the same way, you know, across these places when I'm doing my job as a human being. Well, does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes, it does. In a similar situation, our son, who, well, he didn't have any trauma, thankfully. He does have a peanut allergy, so we're always concerned about that. He's got an EpiPen that goes with him everywhere. Carter comes with a bag. But he was spending 2 weeks with me at the office because of a daycare situation. And sometime after that 2 weeks was up, one of my reports, one of the people working for me asked, Rob, why do you treat us like your son, like you treat your son, who was 12 at the time? And one of my people who had been working for me longer, he's like, no. He treats his son like he treats us, and vice versa. There's no difference, because that's how you are as a human. That's how you need to be as a human. And being anything is you as a human. It's what it has to be.
Yeah. And obviously you'll have different conversations and some things are going to be a little more awkward or less awkward. You know, but it's funny. I was talking to an ex-coworker about a month or so ago, and he was like, you know, one of the things I love about you is like, you sort of like a conflict de-escalator. And even when you come in as a mediator to conflict, it very quickly feels like it's no longer conflict. And I was thinking about that because Wednesday evening, I was doing something upstairs, and then my spouse sent me a Slack message and was like, hey, when you're done, I need you to mediate a dispute between our son and me. So I came down and I was like, what's your stance? The dispute was over an incredibly critical issue, which is scoop of ice cream, of course.
It's very important.
Yeah, well, you know, ice cream. And I listened to both. And then I said, look, you, spouse, are factually exactly correct. Like, I find in your favor in this dispute. And also, our son has had a really crappy day. He told me while I was taking him from camp that he was literally thinking he was going to die, like, during that anxiety attack. And that's rough for anybody, but especially like an 8-year-old, dude. So I was like, I told my son, look, my spouse, look, you're right. You won this dispute. Is this really what you want to actually do, though, given his day? And she was like, yeah, that's a good point. And he got this scoop that, you know, he wanted. And then she was like, oh, that's, you know, you're such a great mediator. And I was like, yeah, that feels very much like, you know, what I do.
Yeah, we actually do a similar thing. We don't actually have to do it much anymore, although we still do play with it. We have the, are we playing the right or wrong game, or are we playing the connection game? And we noticed each other playing the right and wrong game a lot with one another, right? And what we said, and this was during COVID, and the promise that we made to each other was, we will call each other out right? So like I said to our son, I was like, if you feel like I'm playing the right or wrong game, you get to call me out and you get to say, hey, mom, are you playing the right or wrong game or the connection game? And it goes all ways. And we probably did it for a few months over COVID where we weren't going out a bunch and we were spending way more time together than we were in the past. And now it's like, I don't know, my assessment of the situation, Rob may have a different one, is that we play the right or wrong game a lot less and we play the connection game a lot more. It's not about who's right, because either way, often either way, you're right. Right? Can you have the scoop of ice cream or not? I could be right either way. It's not about that. It's about how do we connect with one another and how do we nurture one another and love one another even more. And so I think that that lesson, actually, I know that that lesson is applicable at home, but it's also applicable at work and so many other areas as well. And for many people, that's a, oh, wow, you mean like I can be at work like I am as a dad and a husband? Oh, cool. Again, thank you for that permission slip to just be who I am and not try to be someone else.
You know, obviously I'm not going to tell you all how to run your lives and what game, which game you want to play. I think for me, both at work and at home, one of the things I try to pay attention to is I don't really care which game we play. I just want to make sure that everybody involved in the game is actually playing the same game.
Mm, there you go.
So it's okay to play the right and wrong game, as long as everybody playing the right and wrong game actually is trying to play the right and wrong game rather than the connection game. So the first thing I try to just make sure is like, wait, is like, what are the goals here? This is, by the way, a really good example. Look, I love my spouse, and my spouse is better than me at a lot of things and is also very different from me. And my spouse is also a litigating attorney. So my spouse, for one reason or another, got into a profession where basically my spouse gets to formally argue. And it's all about right and wrong. And my spouse feels very deeply and very attached to right and wrong. And that's okay. I'm not actually going to try to make my spouse think or work differently. It also is super useful because there are cases where we need somebody to go fight. And my spouse is much better at this than I am. But sometimes if you understand what game people are playing, you don't even have to change the game. You can actually just sort of go like in this case, my spouse was playing the right and wrong game. My son was playing essentially the I'd like some ice cream game. I could actually satisfy both of them and make them feel like they both got what they wanted by giving both of them what they wanted, because my spouse got to be right and my son got to have ice cream.
There you go.
Total win-win.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So I'm going to change gears a little bit to back to talking about career and career trajectory. So Rob used a phrase a little bit earlier that I actually wanted to dive in a little bit more on, which is pro leisure circuit. So this is something I learned about from being in the RANS Leadership Slack, and there's a channel in the RANS Leadership Slack called the pro leisure circuit. So Roy, to what extent are you familiar with what that is? And would you consider yourself to be on the pro leisure circuit right now?
I feel like I'm familiar with it. My sense is it's not people who have retired, but it's people who are certainly sort of basically taking a break for a while and are not really looking for their next job. Is that about the right definition?
That's my sense too. But yeah, I've only been in the channel for like a couple of weeks now, but that's definitely my sense of it too. Yeah.
I hate it so much. I mean, to be clear, not the term, not other people doing it, but at the risk, not the risk, I'm actually going to do it. It's not a risk if you're actually doing something. I'm going to expose a bunch of the topics. Well, actually one topic that I've had a bunch of conversations with my therapist about. You know, I fundamentally only really consider, I don't consider myself to have like an innate right to exist. I fundamentally need to have impact and make a difference in order to feel like, you know, I'm earning my keep on the face of this planet, basically. Now, I want to be very clear. This is not one of the things anybody should emulate. If you have this perspective, and I know a bunch of other people who have this perspective, you know, if it's working out, if it works well for you, that's great. Just think about, you know, what the costs are. I'm working on it very slowly, but fundamentally, I need to belong to a team and I need to feel like I'm making a difference and an impact, going back to what I look for in a job. So I'm very much, I mean, I'm taking the summer a little slow because for most of the summer, I've actually got the kids by myself, which is a new and interesting and terrifying experience. I'd like to think more terrifying for them than for me. No, wait, it's supposed to be the other way around, I think. Anyway, for most of the summer, I have the kids by myself. So I don't have as much of an availability to like do, you know, interviews, for example, or and if I got a job before the end of August, I would need to do with like childcare stuff. I've also gotten into 3D printing, which is a fun and expensive and frustrating hobby. But I very much want to find my next job. And it's not so much a financial thing. Netflix is legendary for having generous severance packages. And Netflix treated me really well. I also, you know, was investing in Netflix options back, you know, in 2014 and 2015. So I'm not going to be worried about money until like, you know, the end of the year. But I want to belong, Jen. And I want to like go to a workplace where I work with people and I'm in relatively short order starting to sort of like, you know, help other people have a better experience of their workplace.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can feel the authenticity of that. I can feel the work that you've done, the internal self-reflection work that you've done on that, because I also knew people who, oh, I need to be of service, right? I need to be doing something or else I don't feel good. I get anxious, like, you know, and so that's coming from a very different place where it's like, I need to keep busy or else all the demons in my head are going to destroy me kind of thing. That's a completely different kind of situation versus like, here's the experience I want to have in this life. And while it's cool, like it's fine, I'll ride this wave. What I want, what I ultimately desire is to be a member of a team and to belong and to have an impact. So that's really awesome.
And, you know, the good news for me is, so I left Netflix involuntarily. It's the classic involuntary regretted. In other words, it was a elimination of role. It was a very positive and it was actually, frankly, emotionally confusing to a lot of people. Because people were like, how are you doing with this? And I was like, I'm fine. Like, you know, it's all good. And they were like, oh, so you were kind of hoping to leave. And I was like, no, I want to be clear. I did not want to leave.
Yeah.
But the way this happened, like, okay with me. Like I literally had somebody, so I was a boomerang at Netflix and I had somebody in my leadership chain sort of email me that last week and go like, hey, so let's see if we can continue the cycle and have you come back for a third time at some point. But it was an involuntary departure. And involuntary departures can be rough, but I'm also here to tell you, like, they get easier as you go along. And this was either my third or fourth involuntary departure. The first one was heck. I got to tell you, like, 1993, maybe, I think I actually lost my job. It was my first tech job. I remember spending like 6 weeks in bed being sure that I was never going to have another good job and I was going to like end up working at McDonald's. Fun story. I mentioned this to somebody who knows me pretty well a few years back. And he was like, Roy, you would like, you thought you'd work at McDonald's? There's no way you could survive at McDonald's. Like you, that's not a career you could have. And I was like, okay, but that's beside the point. So my first involuntary termination was rough. My second one was easier. My third one was, you know, a lot easier. At this point, I have the benefit of having gone through a few of these and having pretty consistently seen them work out to my advantage. You know, I left my first tech job making 25K a year. And I came, my next job, which I started about 2 months later, I was making 40K a year, which is more.
Yes.
I left Robert Half. I remember as I was part of a riff at Robert Half and my boss walked me out and I was like, well, you know, at least my commute is going to be shorter because Robert Half was in Pleasanton. So that's like 50 miles away. My commute ended up actually not being that much shorter because Netflix was, you know, a lot further than most of the other companies I was looking at. But it's also worth noting, I got a 50% pay raise going from Robert Half to that other company. Things have, relatively speaking, worked out for me in my life. And as I mentioned, I tend to be, relatively speaking, an optimist.
Yeah.
So this is a fun and interesting time, but I'm certainly not looking for it to last longer than it needs to.
Yeah. So I have one more question for you, which you'll see why it's related. One more question that I've kind of jotted down, and then I'm going to throw it back to Rob for whatever other else fun questions he has for you. Retirement. So given that you're on the pro leisure circuit right now, which can feel a lot like retirement to some people, but maybe not. I'm curious what your view, your meaning, are you looking forward to retirement? Are you not? Is this something that you're like, oh, this doesn't even exist in my world, which I've heard people say? What are your views on retirement, and what do you want that to look like, if it's even a thing?
Oh my gosh, this is timely. So last week I got a phone call from some unrecognized number, and I answered that call, and it was like somebody from Fidelity. And they're like, hey, I'm calling from Fidelity. We have your Netflix 401k with us. And we just got notified by Netflix that you've left the company. So we need to talk about like what's going to happen with the 401k. And I was like, cool. Yeah. So Monday, I sat down with one of their advisors to talk about my 401k, my rollover IRA with them. And he was like, look, what are you hoping to get right now? And I was like, look, generally speaking, my approach to managing money is characterized by benign neglect. So I'm hoping to have as few conversations about this as possible. And he was like, okay, but we still need to have a better understanding of your retirement. So he was like, at what age would you like to retire? And I was like, honestly, man, I don't want to. Like, yeah. if I live my life right and I'm lucky, my hope is that I work in a place that gives me a ton of fulfillment and satisfaction until the last day I'm alive. And at some point they just find me at my chair and they just think I'm kidding for a while because I'm not responding to their questions until they realize the unfortunate truth because I've started smelling up a bit. That's assuming, of course, I'm going into an office, which, you know, given post-COVID is a different thing, but, you know, that's a little more less open-ended than like, why has Roy not gotten into any of our Zoom calls for the last week? So that's my answer. I don't want to retire.
Yeah, I love that.
I am of a similar opinion where as I want to continue to be providing value, and it's what we espouse with everyone that we can, that you continue putting value out and you receive value back. But also, yeah, you put value out into the world. That's part of who you are as a person. It's how you help to make the world better a little bit every day. And so when you're thinking about your future trajectory, do you see there being a Roy company at any point in time where any entrepreneurial bend, or is it always going to be Roy as a guy behind the guy behind the person making other things work?
Hopefully it's not going to be the guy behind the guy. One of the reasons I left Netflix in 2017 to go to Slack was to go work for this woman named Julia Grace. And I got pretty close with Julia. I still consider her a friend. And I remember at some point, I ended up leaving Slack to go back to Netflix and working for this VP called Jason Chan, who has since retired. For the definition of retirement that Jason uses. Jason is of Asian American descent. And I remember talking to Julia and I was like, wow, you know, what would it be if for the rest of my career, every job I picked, I was not working for a white dude? We'll see how that goes. I think it's unlikely, but you know, it's a nice dream.
It is. But
my point is, first of all, I like having somebody to follow. I like having a leader, and I have a very specific following style. And it's one of the things that I've talked to a bunch of hiring managers actually for the last few years. One of the things I tell them is like, look, I am hard and expensive to manage, but I'm pretty easy to lead. But for the right leader, I'm apparently a joy. And for the wrong leader, and not like a bad leader, just depends on your style, I'm a massive pain in the neck. And you really should know what you're buying before you buy me, because you know, otherwise you could end up like significantly regretting it. But I like having a leader, at least a leader for whom I can be the kind of follower I am. I don't know that I think of myself as somebody who, you know, could or would run a company. I was once part of a four-person company, so I was a co-founder. And the least interesting and fun parts of that job were dealing with like marketing and sales, but also like 401ks and benefits and all of that stuff. I like having a bunch of that infrastructure dealt with. One, two, I don't really see myself as a person at the top. I like being part of an organization. Three, I don't know that I have that much to offer, honestly. More relevant, I would say. People keep asking whether or not I'm going to write a book, given all the blog posts I've written about leadership, some of whom have apparently resonated with people. And I don't know, I feel like that's a lot of pressure to actually do good work in one big chunk. So I'm much more fond of the, you know, blogging approach than the here buy my book approach. And it's one of the reasons, by the way, why I've shied away, even during this time of semi-leisureness, from looking into a professional coaching role. Because I don't like the idea of making people pay. I'm okay making companies pay for me. But once somebody is paying, like once a human being pays for me, it's hard for me to believe that they would actually get their money's worth from that interaction. I'd much rather have those conversations for free, because then the pressure and anxiety of making sure that somebody got their time and money's worth is much, much lower.
Mm, I hear that. I hear that. I will share that before I started the People Stack, I basically said the same things. Like I was an academic, like in my prior life, right? So it was like had the freedom, but was working for somebody else. And I said the same things. Like I don't ever want to have to deal with marketing or sales or the pressure of somebody paying me. And then, oh my gosh, I have to deliver. And, you know, 10, 15 years later, where I'm at is it's actually an even greater level of peace and serenity, but also like personal sovereignty and power around owning what I'm responsible for and letting other people own what they're responsible for. Along the way, you know, like getting pretty good enough to build a profitable business at marketing and sales. So it was like, I was allergic to it before. and I don't know, you know, what exactly it was. It was a series of things where like the allergy just kind of disappeared. And now I absolutely love it. So I share that for you, Roy, but also anybody who's listening, because we hear that a lot. And I don't know if it's like the entrepreneurial bug is like dichotomous. It's like you either have it or you don't. But for me, there was at one point that I had in my life, I was like, nope, don't have it. I need to have a job. I need to have those stable paychecks. And now I'm like, I could never go back to somebody else being my boss. So it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, Jen, I mean, no disrespect in this, but I would say one of the differences between us is that you're actually good at this.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I think that you're great at it too. I think that you could be anyway. I appreciate the compliment though. I really do.
The other thing is I do actually find this tremendous amount of personal satisfaction from having somebody to follow. Like in a way, I really am emotionally driven to have a leader to report to. And again, like the way I report to people, the way I follow them is not necessarily everybody's cup of tea. When I worked for Julia at Slack, maybe about once a month, I would get into an argument with her at her staff meetings. You know, she would say that she wanted us to do something. And I'd be like, some version of like, well, let's talk about that for a second. And, you know, probably about 50% of the time she'd reach out to me afterwards on Slack and be like, hey, thanks for modeling the kind of behavior I want from the rest of my staff. I did the same before I left Netflix. I was working for their CISO, Vitaly. And I disagreed with Vitaly so much all the time. But I also had a conversation with him at some point where I was like, look, Vitaly, here's what I want. I want to know what matters to you. And I want to take that and make that what matters to me. And then do everything in my power to fulfill on that within, you know, obviously ethical and legal, you know, boundaries. And that will mean that I will do things sometimes that you may not even like or agree with in service of these goals that you have. And my commitment is to always take your feedback. And my commitment is to always also be able to explain to you why what I'm doing is in service of your goals. How does that work for you? And he was like, you know, that works pretty well for me. It's deeply emotionally fulfilling for me to sort of, you know, do that, to have that sort of leader.
I love it.
One of the challenges we get to help people with is threading the needle specifically that you're working through right now, Roy, where they want to work for someone, They want to have a clear trajectory, and they don't necessarily want to be in the C-suite, but they want to have meaning. They want to have impact. They want to have voice. When you're thinking about being intentional about this particular job search where you want to have that voice, but not necessarily be so high, what are some of the criteria that you're using to help level set that?
We'll talk about maybe two. One is the company values and how it thinks about the role and what it's supposed to do. Just to make things easy and not complicated, I'm going to not name any sort of company, but I've certainly, like, I've known companies that have been like, oh, as a people leader, your job is to extract maximum value from your team. And that's okay. Like, you don't, you get to say that, much like I mentioned to Jen earlier, like, you want to play the right or wrong game, that's fine. So let's just make sure everybody's playing the right, the same game. If you want to play the let's squeeze everything out of our people game, great, fantastic. I'm not going to judge it. But I'm probably not going to be very effective in that place, because what I'm driven to make an impact in is not necessarily that. So one is sort of cultural alignment with the role and how the company sees human beings, and essentially how it thinks about human beings. You know, we've got to the point where a lot of people have an intrinsic and reasonable allergic reaction to the idea of talking about people as resources. And I'm going to do that right now, because I think that for companies, people are resources. They are a thing that we pay for. And the reason we pay for that thing is to get some value out of it. In, you know, most commercial capitalist companies. So that's okay. But I think the fundamental question that I look at in a way is, what is the time horizon over which you're trying to maximize the impact and the value from your people? Is it on a day by day by day by day basis, which is sort of classically how you get into basically, hey, how many lines of code did you contribute this day or week? Or is it about basically taking this unbuilt land and making it better in a way that works for the land and making it deeply fertile for years to come? I have no problem with resource utilization and with thinking about people as resources and with thinking about how to get the most value out of them. I just want to think about that on a time horizon of years. And keeping in mind that unlike my laptop or this land, these are actual humans who get to consent and for whom this has to work as well. That's not some sort of like, oh, my job is to take care of my people or to defend my people. Like, I hate the term shit umbrella. I think it's extremely problematic. But I think it's about making sure that the long-term perspective on how the relationship with our people benefits the company and benefits them is the primary lens through which we look at organizational culture. So companies that have that culture are more likely to be the companies that I want to work at. The other one is essentially looking at the role and figuring out whether or not that is a place where I'm likely to be able to have that sort of impact. And again, part of the way that looks is, what is the actual role? And it's less about internal or it's less about sort of like seniority, other than I would say two things. One, not so much about seniority. I love working for internal teams. I'm willing to work on like external product stuff, but the thing that I love about working for internal teams is I get to talk to stakeholders and customers directly because they're coworkers. The other one is I can, again, as I mentioned, be far more effective mentoring and leading leaders than I am engineers. One of the things that I came to realize over the last year or so is I think every leader gets, like, leaders aren't good or bad. Leaders are good for some people who report to them and are bad for some people who report to them. I actually have a blog post about basically like every leader will have an impact on their report, which can be roughly characterized as like green, yellow, or red. Green means I have made you better. Red means reporting to me has made you worse, at least for the duration of you reporting to me. And yellow, which is most of the time, at least for me, is like, it's value neutral. Me as a leader has not made a positive, a meaningful positive or negative impact on you. For early career people, I think the yellow band is relatively small. So for early career people, and what I mean by that is either in the case of leaders, people who are relatively new to leadership, your leader is much more likely to be red or green than they are yellow. The more you develop your own sense of your leadership, your leader, the more that yellow zone becomes bigger, because it becomes actually a lot harder to sort of like either knock you out of, you know, performance or help you get better. I tend to be more effective at dealing with more senior tenured leaders than with people who, you know, need to figure out one-on-ones. What is that for? That's for status meetings, right? So those are some things that I think of. And then the last one that I mentioned is I have conversations with the person I'm going to report to about what is it like to have Roy reporting to you? And are you sure you want to buy into that?
When one of the things I love about conversations with you, Roy, is that I'm getting an honest and less filtered response than somebody who's coming into something rah-rah shish kumba and like really trying to market themselves. Have you found yet that your honesty and that level of filtering has worked against you because people are expecting something else? Certainly not to the point that you would change, but has this impacted you yet?
Yes, but also to the point that I would change.
Okay.
What's communication for? Communication, fundamentally, I would argue, when we're being intentional, is about affecting a particular change in the head of the person you're communicating with. You know, when you tell Jen that you love her, it's really because you're actually, like, if you're being responsible and intentional, it's because you want to affect some sort of change in Jen's head. And I've known people who have basically gone to their partner at some point and been like, you're the worst. You are a piece of garbage. And you know what they're doing? They are also trying to affect a particular change in their partner's head. Every piece of communication is in order to actually affect some sort of change. And if we're being thoughtful and deliberate, we are aware of that change and we're thoughtful about what we need to say and how we need to come across to affect that change. And that means that, like, it's not about me being authentic or genuine or like me being me and like I'm not going to change. Like, whoever I'm talking with, I need to adjust to how they want to deal with me in order to make sure that the communication is as effective as possible. And with some people, that means being highly filtered and being highly thoughtful and not like sort of bringing in like Roy, the sort of exuberant and, you know, Israeli guy. It's being very, you know, it's being more quiet, potentially. It's being more deliberate. It's being more diplomatic. It's whatever it's going to take to have the conversation and the communication go effectively well.
Beautiful. And I love that. Completely unprompted, you've said two of our favorite words throughout our conversation tonight, and those are intention and context. When you are intentional about what you're trying to achieve and you are aware of the context, there's very little that you could do that won't be in service of your goals.
I think that's perhaps more optimistic. Well, so what you talked about here is awareness and intention. And I think you're 2/3 of the way there. Forgive me, I'm going to argue with you. Are you okay with an argument for a second?
Oh, yeah.
So I would argue intention and awareness are good. But the thing that I would add to that is competence. Because I've literally worked with people who had a particular intention in mind and who had the awareness of the situation in mind, But what they missed was the competence of figuring out how to craft their communication.
Mm.
And that's kind of like the worst case scenario in a way, because we're not talking about a jerk. We're not talking about an asshole. We're talking about somebody who's actually trying to do really well and just failed to have the communication skills to deliver that really, really well. And yeah, that's kind of sad. You know, I had a boss once. He was relatively new to me. There was a reorg. And about a month after I started reporting to him, he had to deliver my pay raise new information for the next year. So we sat down. And he basically said, and the way Netflix was doing comp at the time was it was independent of your performance. It was just like, we pay you top market. This is what we think the top market is. So the conversation ends up being super easy because it's not about your performance. It's like, look, for your job, we believe the top of market has moved to this number. So this is what we're paying you. What he chose to do, though, was have a conversation about my performance. So he was telling me that I was getting a 14% raise, which, by the way, can I tell you, by the way, in my book, 14% raise is not bad. Like, that's pretty great. So he was telling me that I got a 14% raise, and I left that conversation, immediately started talking to recruiters about leaving the company. And why? Because the way he had that conversation was poor. He screwed it up. Because in an effort to basically let me know that actually I could make a lot more money than that, he ended up basically talking about how I wasn't doing things particularly well, and I could basically get better at what I'm doing. Completely unintentional. So his intent was good. The context he was coming in was correct. The skill that he had to have that conversation was terrible. So the conversation he wanted to have from a communication and from like a outcome perspective was exactly 180 degrees from the conversation he ended up having.
Mm-hmm.
And all the time.
Yeah, I 100% agree. We have more than one client that I can think of who the intention was there, the awareness of it was there, they're doing the work except around the communication. And that was exactly why they hired us. And those are like some of our holy shit success stories, where it was like a matter of weeks, somebody gets a promotion, where it was like, oh man, I don't know how to ask for a promotion. Can you just show me how to ask for a promotion? It's like, okay, is that really it? So we check in. If that's really it, okay, cool. And basically did some role playing about how to ask for a promotion, and he got it. He just didn't know how to ask. It wasn't even that he couldn't bring himself. He was confident in himself, in the value that he was delivering. And so, yeah, I think for a lot of people that it's like, I want to do well. I want to make an impact. I simply need help with the communication aspect of it and dialing in the communication aspect of it. And that's really fun stuff for us. And that's actually, I think, some of the easiest work to do if that's actually the only thing of those three things. But a lot of times it might show up as a communication problem, but what it really is, it would be like a mindset problem / an awareness problem, an intention problem, a confidence problem, or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
So wonderful. I've answered all of my questions. Is there anything you want to bring to us, Roy?
Can't think of anything other than, you know, I'm deeply grateful that we got to have that chat and that you reached out. I really enjoyed these 2 hours with you all, and I hope it was, well, ideally useful, but if not useful, at least somewhat entertaining to you and, you know, your listeners.
I believe it was both. And for the record, were there to be a Roy Rappaport book, I would buy a copy.
You know, it would
at
be
least one.
It would be full of puns and sarcasm. There's a reason why isroybeingsarcastic.com exists.
Yes. And I would enjoy every minute of it.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And I echo everything that Rob is saying. This has absolutely felt useful, which I mean in the highest sense, that useful is a really, really big compliment to me. And so yeah, useful conversation, also fun as well. Pleasure to have this conversation with you.
To y'all, it's a lovely way to end the week.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Well, thank you very, very much, Roy, for your time. I know that is valuable for you as well, as you're being intentional about your summer and your job search. It's been absolutely delightful.
Yeah, me too. I'll talk to you all soon.
Excellent.
Take care.
And that wraps up another episode of the PeopleStack podcast. Thanks for listening and for supporting our mission. We are all helping to positively transform the tech world, one tech leader at a time. I have so much gratitude for all of you, for our badass clients, our loyal listeners, every one of you who we've worked with. And I have to give a special shout out to my husband, Rob Allen. He's my co-CEO, the love of my life, PeopleStack Client Zero. And it is such a fun ride, finding new, ridiculously unreasonable levels of prosperity, joy, and fun with him every single day. And a quick thank you to Ketza for creating the catchy, inspiring theme music that we get to use in our podcast. We love each and every one of you. Big, big hugs, aloha, and mahalo.